morning. Thank you very much for coming so early in the morning to our panel. And I should like to welcome you. The title of our panel is Citizens of Plural Worlds, Family and Nation in the Age of Globalization. And our first speaker is Manishita Das, and she is lecturer in film studies at Royal Holloway, University of London, and has previously taught at the University of Michigan and Swarthmore College. She has published essays in the Cinema Journal and in the edited collection Global Art Cinema. And Manishita is currently completing a book titled Outside the Lettered City, Cinema, Modernity and Spectatorship in Late Colonial India. Over to Manishita.
Thank you, Anya. Thank you for being here at this ungodly hour. This paper is quite exploratory. I'll be drawing on a growing body of writing about the diasporic or transnationally mobile family in contemporary Bombay cinema, and on my own work, my ongoing research on 1950s Bombay cinema, to offer some fairly general comments about how the trope of the family is used in two transitional moments in the history of Bombay cinema, the commercially oriented Hindi language film industry based in Bombay, to articulate rather different ideas of citizenship. And my hope is that by juxtaposing these two moments, I can provide some, juxtaposing these two moments can provide an interesting perspective on the relationship between national and transnational forms of belonging. And I have to add that for those of you here in the audience who work on, who are very familiar with Bombay cinema, some of this might be kind of fairly obvious and evident. But I was trying to think about this in the context of this panel. All right, so in the first case, contemporary Bombay cinema, 1990s to the present, citizenship is articulated along the axis of transnational belonging, while in the second, 1950s Bombay cinema, it's much more closely tied to a territorial sense of the nation. Now, the transnational and the diasporic are often celebrated as sites of hybridity and heterogeneity, and contrasted with the homogenizing thrust of the national, which is often seen as producing essentialized nativist notions of identity. However, as I hope to show in my talk, the privileged family fictions of Bombay cinema of the 1990s and the 1950s don't always neatly map onto this binary, and in fact unsettle easy equations of the transnational or globalization with progressive politics and the nation or the national with nativism. So I'm going to talk first about the family fictions of the 1990s. As some of you already know, some of the most successful films to come out of the Bombay film industry in the 1990s are domestic dramas that locate themselves almost exclusively within the private sphere of the home. And this is usually an extremely opulent home, insulated against any disturbances in the public sphere. And it's inhabited by an extended upper caste Hindu family that is patriarchal, usually enormously wealthy, deriving its wealth from business ventures, and frequently diasporic or transnationally mobile. As Madhav Prasad has pointed out, many of these films have brought the NRI, or the non-resident Indian, decisively into the center of the picture, the more stable figure of Indian identity than anything found than anything that can be found indigenously. Now, this is a drastic departure from earlier representations of the diasporic family, the diasporic Indian family, as deracinated and utterly dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. Recent films, such as The Wale Dulhania Le Jayenge, Pardes, and Kabhi Khushi Kabhi Gham, which I'm going to refer to as K3G, among others, have recast the diasporic subject as the authentic Indian who carries India in the heart and is anchored to, and is firmly anchored in Indian tradition through the effective ties of family, conservative social codes, religious faith, and the performance of very elaborate and spectacular Hindu rituals in everyday life and around special occasions like weddings. And a dramatic conflict in these films usually centers on the tension between individual choice and a sense of duty to one's family or one's parents, or to an essentialized notion of tradition. The conflicts, however, remain fairly muted and are resolved through a wishful, a kind of fantasy scenario that brings individual desire in line with the dictates of tradition. indicating that the parents are usually the father, you know, the figure most often played by Amitabh Bachchan, knows best. Now, in this fantasy version of the Hindu feudal family, the feudal patriarch, who was often a figure of oppressive authority in Hindi films of earlier decades, is recast as a benevolent despot and often as a corporate giant, as in K3G, who effortlessly moves between the traditional sphere of the home and the corporate world of the 21st century and equally effortlessly maintains a strict hierarchy of power and the purity of Indian family values within the home. Now, as many scholars have pointed out, films like K3G engage in a rebranding of Indian as Hindu and define Hinduism itself in very narrow and regionalist terms, ignoring the heterogeneity of Hinduism and the plurality of religious faiths and practices, secular beliefs and ethnic identities in India and the Indian diaspora. So these films thus simultaneously transgress the boundaries of the nation state, which is often celebrated as, in critical discourse, as a progressive move in itself, and redraw the boundaries of the nation much more narrowly and dogmatically than some earlier nationalist attempts to envision the national family as heterogeneous and hybrid, and as a community that needs to be created rather than as a primordial entity that's given. So as such, these contemporary films have been read in the context of a large-scale attempt to redefine Indianness in overtly Hindu, overtly and narrowly Hindu terms, an attempt spearheaded on the political front by a coalition of Hindu right-wing parties since the 1980s. The revamping of the diasporic subject has also been tied to the growing importance of South Asian diasporic audiences for the Bombay film industry, which now earns a significant percentage of its profits from its overseas markets. It's also been tied to the centrality of the non-resident Indian investor in India's post-liberalization economic scenario, one created when the Indian economy was opened up to the forces of the free market in the 1990s. And finally, these films have also been seen as speaking not just to diasporic desires and anxieties, but to socio-cultural anxieties generated by India's economic liberalization. Excuse me. Now, several scholars have suggested that the popularity of these films is tied to the aspirations of an upwardly mobile Indian middle class, both within India and in the Indian diaspora, and to their desire to retain a certain configuration of Indian values while embracing the options offered by the global marketplace. So diasporic desire and anxieties, in other words, have become part of the cultural imaginary of Bombay cinema through a cinematic makeover of the Indian family. Now, I'd like to juxtapose this revamped version of the Indian family, as offered by films like K3G, to Bombay cinema's narration of the new nation in the 1950s, India's first decade of independence. And just to give you a little bit of context, this was a period of mass migrations as well, caused by the Second World War, the famines of the 1940s, the demands of a state-sponsored program of industrialization, and of course the partition of India in 1947, which was accompanied by horrifying genocidal violence and uprooted millions of people from their homes, from their homelands. So there was a massive influx of economic and political refugees and seasonal migrants into the cities, and this created staggering problems of resettlement and economic provision. And this period is marked, in fact, by the expansion of an urban underclass and the creation of what has been called the unintended city of the poor. Now, the Bombay cinema of the 50s draws our attention to this unintended city, which incidentally also came to provide it with a large chunk of its audience in this period. It does so in a populist register rather than through codes of social realism, and in part under the influence of left-wing cultural activists who came to work in the Bombay film industry in the 50s as directors, scriptwriters, lyricists, composers, etc. Now, several of the iconic Bombay films of this decade focus on the trials of the urban underclass, on characters uprooted from social and familial moorings. The paradigmatic hero of the 1950s was an impoverished orphan or social outsider who's adrift in a disorienting metropolis and relies more on the kindness of strangers than on the support of kinfolk, who in most places are absent. Or in the comfort of tradition, as he attempted to fabricate a self and a home in a transitional society. So just to give you a couple of examples, the hero of Raj Kapoor's 420, one of the most successful films of his period, is an orphan. He's an unemployed graduate who comes to Bombay in search of work without really knowing anyone there. the hero of Guru Dutt's Arpar, another really popular film, is a frequently unemployed cab driver and mechanic fending for himself on the streets of Bombay. Several of the very popular films produced by Navketan Studios, like Taxi Driver and Kalabazar, focus on sort of proletarian or downward immobile lower middle class heroes, or anti-heroes in some cases, as they navigate an urban landscape of broken dreams, class barriers, and petty crime with little or no support from family or kinfolk. The lone hero, however, soon acquired a de facto family, a surrogate family, made up of a few loyal friends, mostly other liminal figures like him. So, for instance, on his first night in Bombay, Raj, the hero of 3420, is befriended by a community of pavement dwellers, mostly at the behest of the matriarch of this community, an elderly street vendor who becomes his surrogate mother, in a way. The hero of Arpar, the quasi-proletarian heroes of the Navketan films like Taxi Driver and Kalabazar, also find loyal allies in other marginal figures with whom they have no familial connections. Street urchins, nightclub dancers, their partners in crime. And this family is almost invariably end with the formation of the heteronormative couple. But the couple here comes to constitute a new kind of family unit rather than being absorbed into a pre-existing a family order. How much time do I have?
Not 30. I've got 13 minutes.
Okay. So as I was saying, this couple kind of, instead of being absorbed into a pre-existing family order, comes to constitute a new kind of family. And the emphasis is on individual choice and romantic attraction rather than on family approval or traditional considerations of caste and community. The fabricated families of these films were thus based on elective affinities, shared predicaments, and a largely secular ethos rather than on ties of blood or a narrowly defined notion of community. They project an utopian vision of the national family created by the coming together of strangers from diverse ethnic, religious, and social backgrounds under the signs of democracy, social justice, and secularism. And one of the most striking articulations of the secular humanist vision of the new Indian nation for me is in the refrain of a song in the 1959 film Dhool Ka Phool. It's about it's a song addressed to a child who was abandoned and who's adopted, so nobody really knows his religion, his religious affiliation, and he's adopted by an elderly Muslim tailor, and he's singing this song to the child, and the refrain goes like this: Tuna Hindu banega, na Musliman banega, insan ka aulad hai, insan banega. So you'll become either a Hindu, not a Muslim, my child. You are the child of human beings, and a human being you'll become. Now, of course, I mean, the secular vision, as several critics have pointed out in recent years, has its own problematic, it is not without its own problems. You know, only a certain degree of majoritarian and class and gender privilege can enable one to occupy the ostensibly unmarked position that is being claimed for the child in the song that I just quoted, and for the heroes of the 1950s films. So almost all the heroes of the 1950s films that I mentioned were nominally Hindu. There are a couple of ambiguous exceptions. But most of them, as you can infer from their names that they're Hindu, their names like Raj, Mangal, Vijay, etc. Although they're not identified by their surnames, which would have associated them with a specific region and ethnic group and also a caste, and thus located them in a specific place and community rather than in the abstract space of the nation, thereby limiting their pan-Indian appeal. These heroes also frequently retain enough of a middle-class sensibility despite their affinities with the disenfranchised and their brushes with homelessness, poverty, etc. That seems to give them a certain moral authority over their proletarian associates. And I think it's crucial to highlight the implicit privileging of a secular Hindu middle-class identity and worldview in this 1950s visions of the national family. However, I think it's also important to note that the identities of these characters were primarily defined not by religions or rituals or lineage, as in the domestic dramas of the 1990s onwards, but by ethical dilemmas revolving around individual and social responsibility. So Raj in 3420, for instance, is torn between his sense of honesty and his quasi-familiar loyalty to the community of pavement dwellers and his desire for a good life that he cannot really acquire through legal or very ethical means. Kallu in Arpar and many of the heroes of the Navketan films attempted to choose crime as a viable career option, especially when the alternatives are unemployment and poverty. And some do give in to temptation, though they all end up doing the right thing at the end. Although the endings are somewhat ambiguous. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that their dilemmas are couched not in terms of religion or tradition versus modernity, but in terms of ethical obligations and in terms of the contradictions of the post-colonial nation state's project of modernity, which very ambitiously recast the city as the engine of a modernizing, democratizing, pluralistic India, but which also failed to deliver the rights of social citizenship to the majority of the Indian population. So just wrapping up, I've so far focused on the differences between the two sets of family fictions, but in wrapping up, I'd like to draw attention to the similarities underlying this apparently different sets of family fictions. So first of all, it's obvious that powerful ideas of the nation or national identity underpin both sets of narratives. So ironically enough, the fantasies of transnational belonging spun by the family entertainers of the 1990s seem to be predicated on an idea of India that is far less inclusive and pluralistic than the vision of the national family articulated in the 1950s films. That's not to say, obviously, as I've already remarked, that the fantasies of the 1950s films do not contain their own exclusions and hierarchies, especially in relation to class and gender. And that brings me to my second and concluding point. Both sets of narratives, I'd argue, are about the forging of a new patriarchy, the assertion of an authoritative masculinity, even though the form really differs. So the 1950s films grapple with the problem of creating a new hero, a new citizen subject who would be at home in modernity, free from the constraints of a feudal past and sectarian identity, and better equipped, much better equipped than the feudal patriarch, to deal with the challenges of modernist projects of nation building and social redistribution in the context of projects that are articulated in the context of a global modernity. In the 1990s films, the feudal patriarch, sidelined by the 1950s films, reemerges, now transformed from an icon of feudal authoritarianism and backwardness into someone who combines the comforts of conservatism with the promise of a consumerist modernity. Appearing to be equally at home in the world of tradition and the globalized world of capital, he offers a fantasy resolution to the perceived problems of globalization for the burgeoning middle-class audiences of Bombay cinema, both in India and abroad. So they seem to speak to each other across the national-transnational divide, and in fact disrupt a kind of linear mapping of the movement from the national to the transnational. I should add that my objective is not to pose the family narratives of the 1950s as the good object against the family melodramas of the 1990s, although it's probably clear where my sympathies lie. But rather, I was trying to think about these narratives and their underlying politics in relation to one another, and to highlight the need for a political history of changing representations of the family in Bombay cinema, a history that will connect representational shifts to shifting configurations of cultural citizenship and to changes in the Bombay film industry. Thank you.